I will tell anybody that if you get the opportunity to have a sales role or a role on a sales team, even if you're not the salesperson, just being around that atmosphere, you learn so much.
Welcome to the Happy Engineer Podcast, the place where we help engineers to build your career, balance your life, and be happy. My name is Zach White, a former engineer now turned CEO, lifestyle engineering coach, and your host. I believe that success without fulfillment is failure. Join me each week as we bring you an inspiring leader or message to help you enjoy both. Thanks for investing time with me today. Now let's do this. What does it take to lead a $10 billion engineering organization? And how do you get there from here? That's billion with a B as in Bravo, an 11-figure business for those counting. Picture your goals and dreams for a moment. Why are you not getting a seat at the table? What's keeping you from being the obvious next choice for promotion? We look at that question today with my good friend, Vice President and Global Platform Leader at Whirlpool Corporation, Casey Tubman. Casey shares his incredible career growth from engineering plastic parts for Case International Harvester to leading the largest international engineering team at Whirlpool. If you have questions about your career path, getting your MBA, how to plan and execute your first 90 days in a new role, or the most important actions you can take to earn a seat at the table you care about most, you are going to get massive value from this conversation. Casey earned his bachelor's in mechanical engineering from the University of Michigan and his executive MBA from Mendoza College of Business at Notre Dame. And for those of you who know college sports, I would consider that a house divided, but a powerhouse for sure. We talk in depth about Casey's growth mindset from IC all the way to VP. As you move up, your shadow gets longer. Casey takes that leadership responsibility seriously, and I know that you're going to feel that energy during our chat. So pull up a chair, because this is one table you're already invited to. If you're an engineer and you want to be happier, healthier, and wealthier in your career and life, we would love to talk to you. In other episodes, I explain a bit more, but all you need to know is that I've carved out a limited number of $500 coaching sessions just for podcast listeners for free to gain extreme clarity on your current career blocks and barriers and to determine your personal action plan. Grab a time while they're still available on careerclaritycall.com. That's in the show notes. Click the big orange button, pick a time to chat for 15 minutes with one of our coaches, and they'll take care of the rest. Let's do this. Casey, welcome to the Happy Engineer Podcast. It's amazing to see you again. It's been several years since our last face-to-face conversation, and can't thank you enough for making time to be on the show today, man.
Happy to be here, Zach, and I appreciate the offer. Going to be an interesting conversation, as many of those we've had in the past.
I was going to say, I've never had a conversation with you that wasn't interesting, at least in some capacity. So it's appropriate, I think, to set the stage really quickly about what you're doing today. Just give us a little understanding in terms of people and product, what it is that you're up to right now.
So I'm back on U.S. soil, but I'm in a global job. So my team is around the world now. I have responsibility for vertical access or top load laundry, as most people call it, all dryers to go with it, and then commercial laundry. And that is basically from the planning stages through to the product development stage and into manufacturing. It's now titled Vice President of Engineering or a Global Platform Leader. And that's not easy to say when you start.
Yeah. Vice President, Global Platform Leader, Vertical Axis Laundry. It is a mouthful, Casey. So
exactly.
Can you, maybe you don't have the numbers perfect, but within a range of tolerance, like how many products annually are we talking about that are in your scope right now?
Volume, you mean?
Volume. Yeah, volume.
Oh, that's a great question. The volume has to be 15 million, maybe, if I had to guess.
You could be off plus or minus a couple million, and it's still a huge number.
It's still a big number, yes. Yeah. Call it 8 to 10 billion in revenue.
Oh, that's awesome. And by far and away the largest category in Whirlpool Corporation. And correct. I have a fond memory because my last engineering leadership role was in what is now your organization. So
yes,
that's tremendous.
You left a little too early. I wasn't back yet.
Well, yeah, maybe I need to reconsider. Are you taking applications, Casey? I don't know if this coaching thing doesn't work out.
I am. I always am.
Casey's always hiring. So anybody listening to this, if you're wanting to lead laundry products for Whirlpool Corp, reach out to Casey. So, all right, let's go back though. Here you are leading the largest engineering organization within Whirlpool Corp globally. If we back up the track, what was your first engineering gig? Take us all the way back to the beginning.
So when I graduated college, I was trying to get a job in Chrysler in cars doing a leadership rotation, let's call it. Every engineer coming out of school looks for is there a leadership rotation? Maybe not all of them, but a lot of them. And of course, I was waiting on that answer, and Case Corporation or Case International Harvester, as many people knew them, came along and said, well, we have a job for you. Here it is. And being the person I was and the family I came from is when you graduated college, you made sure you had a job that you were going to. If one was thinking about you, that didn't count. You had to go to the one that offered you a job. So I took a role with Case International Harvester in Chicago. I was a design engineer, basically, and I was designing the mid-sized tractors. They were produced in Doncaster, England. They were designed in Chicago. And then I was doing rotational molding plastics for gas tanks. I was designing fuel tanks. So I learned all about rotational molding and other plastics types, injection and others. And then I was doing chassis work around battery box compartments, the stairs up into the cab and things like that. So a little bit of metal work as well. Great first job, great first experience, and spent time going over to England and actually going to the factory and meeting with the engineers there and things of that nature.
So when you took that first role, I've heard two different stories from engineers who I coach. Some that first job really doubled down on their passion for engineering. It's like, I love this. This is amazing. I want more of this. And others had that initial reaction of like, this is interesting, but I'm not sure if this is how I want to spend the rest of my career or not. And they spend the next decade trying to figure that out. What category are you in? If you go back to that first job, did it really ignite for you? You loved it or uncertainty?
It ignited it. No, there was no uncertainty. I was doing CAD drafting in high school, actually. I had some state awards, I remember, and drafting by hand. And then I moved to CAD drafting in college. And so coming out, I was doing not only my own design work from an engineering standpoint, I was doing my own drafting and doing some test requests and things with the lab and then the manufacturing guys. I was all in and I loved it. And I still do today. So that type of thing just made it solid that I was going to do engineering for a while. And as you know, I did it for 9 or 10 years before I changed over.
So what was the impetus to head over to Whirlpool?
I actually left Case International, which was, again, I said it was in Chicago. I couldn't afford to live where I actually worked was the problem. I made $37,500 living in Chicago. Super hard at the time. I lived with actually other people because I couldn't afford my own place. And I was coming back to Michigan quite a bit where my family's located up towards Grand Rapids. And so I watched people, how they were doing and what things were happening. I said, this isn't going to work. So I made a job change back to, I went to Steelcase actually in Grand Rapids. Wow. If you're familiar with the pyramid, I just drove by it yesterday with my family and I said, hey, see, that's the pyramid. Like, okay, what's that? I'm like, that's the Steelcase engineering building. Now, I don't think they own it anymore, but at the time it was a really cool building to work in. So I worked there for a little over a year. And then Joe Zarn came and recruited me from there to come to Whirlpool. I was doing design work at Steelcase. I was doing electrical pathways for furniture, for office furniture, wire harness type work along with plastics and metal. Again, things I had done before, but changed it over to office furniture.
Okay.
And then Joe came along and offered me the opportunity to come to Whirlpool and work on washers, really cool new projects. At that time, Calypso, as many people know it, was in the works.
Oh, cool.
And
people listening to this aren't going to know what Calypso is, but my Whirlpool history, that's like legendary from when I started. People talked about Calypso. You know, that was a big project.
It was a very large project. It was a new age washing machine, as we called it back then. It was a good opportunity. I said, yeah, I'm interested. And it's funny because as I came back in February to take this role, one of the guys who I ran into right away, Brenner Sharp, was still working for us in the washer area and is on my team, actually. He was my first boss, not Joe Zarn. Joe Zarn recruited me, but I worked for Brenner Sharp. First year in, Brenner and I had two or three patents on some suspension work that we were doing. So several years in the washer group and several patents later, that was a great first experience here.
That's amazing. So you've got a decade plus of engineering, you know, experiences we could talk about, and then some tremendous stuff after that I want to make sure we dig into. But if you were going to pick a moment that stands out from your engineering career that you're like, this was the pinnacle, this was the coolest thing I worked on, or the most proud accomplishment, does anything stand out to you, Casey, as that peak moment?
I say it all the time when people I talk to, and just in general. There was a project for what's called the fabric freshener, which is not a core washer dryer product, but kind of a accessory that goes with it. Call it a steam cabinet, let's say, but it's collapsible. Yeah. We took that. There were seven engineers on the team, and then we had a marketing person, maybe a GSS person of support or something. But basically, seven of us worked on it for 18 months. We started with the GCD team giving us sketches. And we were partnered up with Black & Decker at the time in Mexico.
Global Consumer Design, for people who don't know the Whirlpool lingo.
Yes.
No worries.
Global Consumer Designer. He gave us the sketches. We started engineering it right away. And we took it from those sketches through all the development phases, all the build phases, tooling it and everything. We tooled it around the world, then brought them back to Mexico. We actually built an assembly line in the Black & Decker factory in Mexico, because they were going to build it for us. We were helping with the design. They were going to build it. And in 18 months, we ran production. So seven people, 18 months, go from sketches to a full production line of a functioning, new to the world appliance. Great team of people to work with. Great thing to work on. Go in and out of Mexico, work on the fact, literally on the factory line ourselves, building the line. You know, we were there when it was going on, and just a great experience. Sometimes smaller projects give you much better experience than the bigger ones.
That's awesome. So I want to hover on this for a moment, because one of the things that comes up again and again and again in these conversations on the podcast is, you call it a high-performing team dynamic. That might be the HR buzzword for it. But there's something about that experience when you do get settled into an amazing team with a great project that has a clear vision and impact that you can actually make the progress and go deliver. Like, something about that dynamic that everybody talks about, like, those are the days. I actually am curious, Casey, for your perspective, why is it, do you think, that so many people have never actually had that experience? Why is it so hard to create those kinds of, you know, dynamics in organizations? It's like everybody's striving for it. All the leaders know how important high-performing teams are, and yet a lot of engineers I coach really have no experience like what you just described to lean back to. What do you think blocks us from having more of that?
For me, the thing that pops up in my head, and I'm seeing it right now, as I said, as I come back into this area, is the teams are very large now, and they're very matrixed and spread out across the world. We were seven people that literally sat in a small corner of this tech center. No one knew what we were there. We were kind of, that's the other thing. I think being out of the spotlight helped us. We cared about each other, even though no one may have cared about what we were doing. Again, it was like the last project on the list, let's call it. And so there were other people that were getting the spotlight and the limelight and everything else. We didn't care. We just wanted to get our stuff done, do it really well, and have a product that we knew the consumer was going to love. All of us loved it as we were designing it. And so we were like, this is the best thing. Consumers are going to love it and it's going to be great. And so we were passionate about it. And so if you have a team of people, they're tight knit and they're focused and they're passionate, it's a great experience. But to your point, you don't get that on every project, because a lot of times you have your small segment that you worked on. And that's maybe another thing with this team. We all played whatever place we needed to, whatever role we needed to play. That's what we did. 1 week, somebody might be on vacation. Another person just had to fill in and do the work.
Yeah, take it over.
We might not have had a person that was, hey, this is, you're the chassis person. We didn't have that. It was, hey guys, we need to do this work. Who's got time this week versus, you know, a month from now?
We're it. This is it.
Let's exactly. Go. When you only have seven, you can't point very far, let's say.
That is super interesting and certainly no easy answer or companies would have solved it by now. But sure. It reminds me, at least in terms of the values you described, I think it's Ronald Reagan gets credit for the quote. It's amazing how much we can accomplish if we don't care who gets the credit.
Yep.
And at least for me, that's something that I find really difficult to instill into that organization because everybody wants the spotlight in some way, even the engineering team. You know, if we want to build our careers and get credit for the great work we're doing, we want to be seen. And that's tough to get people to just fall in love with the project and be passionate about the customer, you know, as you described it. So I don't know. Tough question.
I think one other thing, as you're talking about, Zach, that comes to mind is we didn't actually have the time to worry about who was going to get the credit, to be honest. Again, with seven people, we were so busy. We worked many weekends in this building, in the labs. I can remember many weekends traveling. And during that project, I started doing my MBA. And so I was gone on a Friday and Saturday, but that meant I probably worked the weekend in between, or on Sunday, I had to get some work done, or even on that Friday and Saturday between a class or in the evening or something. And I can remember flying in and out of Mexico. Sometimes I'd fly in literally to go to class, to turn around and then fly back out. At least for me, I didn't have time to worry about who was getting the credit, honestly. And I think the other guys on the team were similar to that. None of them were trying to take all the work and say, oh, I'll take credit for this. I don't think that was ever the case.
Would you say at any point in that 18 months, you felt burned out by the amount of effort and energy it was requiring to get it done?
Honestly, no. And I mean, you know me a little bit. I'm a high energy person, let's say.
Yeah, totally.
And people say, how do you do it? I say, I sleep once in a while. But no, honestly, it was such a great project and we were so passionate about it and we were learning new things. Because again, this was a space like, the material, it was a collapsible, right? So it was a bag material. We had never done bag textiles for heat, steam, and other things. So I got to learn about that through a supplier, travel over to Europe to meet with them and go through all the information, see their factories and things like that. Again, great experience and no time to worry about other things. If you're excited about what you're doing, the burnout doesn't come, let's say.
Right. I get a lot of calls from engineers all around the world, Casey, who are burned out. And one of the first things that always comes up is I'm having to work weekends, I'm having to work nights or, you know, log back on after dinner, after my kids are in bed. And they're looking at the schedule as one of their beliefs on a key driver of burnout. And what I've seen across the board is that doesn't correlate because there's so many examples of people like yourself, or you look into the entrepreneurial space. I look at what I've been doing, you know, building my business and the hours don't create burnout. You know, there's a totally different set of realities. And if you were working those hours, but there was no real passion or purpose behind the project, you didn't want to be there, you didn't have that high performing team, you felt disconnected from the people and the purpose and the customer and all, might be a different answer.
Correct. Right? Yeah. I go back to the quote, right? Love what you do, you'll never work a day of your life.
Yeah, that's good. It's awesome.
So I've experienced that for 25 years now and I'm just continuing to push forward with it as best I can. Try the next thing, you know, try the next thing that see if you love it. And if you love it, you don't really work. So
I love that.
It's panned out well so far.
All right. So you crush it in engineering for a decade and then your resume starts to take a crazy turn away from the typical engineering path. And I won't go through every job, but you know, director of product development. So on the marketing side, a director of sales, a senior director of merchandising, P&L responsibilities and ownership, then a general manager, vice president level role in dishwasher products, doing product marketing at a VP level in EMEA, which is Europe, Middle East and Africa region, going overseas and supporting that. And then back into engineering. So a bit of a hiatus from engineering. I know there's a lot we could unpack in there, but maybe go back to the moment where you first left engineering. What was the thing going on in your mind? Why make that decision? Anything that sort of sparked that desire to walk into the business side and marketing?
Sure. A couple things. So anytime I buy and sell of things, that's kind of my deal. And so when I was an engineer, while I love the engineering work and I'm a hands-on engineer, I still love to get my hands dirty. I was doing it this morning with the guys up in the lab. You know, there's that side. Then there's the other side, which is the business side, which is all about, hey, are we getting the best price for the materials we're buying? Are we really negotiating well? Did we negotiate with a trade partner on the flooring? And are we selling as many as we could? Could I change my pricing a little bit, get a little more margin? Could I do more volume if I lower the price? And there was always that, again, in my mindset, the art of the deal, let's say.
Yeah.
And I love negotiating. So I always had the sense that I want to try the business side at one time and see what it's like and see what the experience is. So as I was in the engineering roles, I decided at some point in time, okay, I'd like to get my MBA. I don't know if I even knew what that meant at that time, to be honest. 25 years old, you're in engineering and you might understand what that means and you might not. I probably did not, to be honest. But I knew it meant I had a ticket to then get a seat at the table to have the conversation. Whereas if I just had my engineering degree, it was going to be much harder to do that. And it's not that it's not possible. It's harder. So I end up getting my MBA, as you know. And then the other thing at Whirlpool, I never went looking for jobs. People always came and knocked on my door or somebody said, hey, you need to go see this person. And I always ask, why do I have to go see that person? I don't even know who that person is. Well, this is who they are. And they're going to talk to you about a job. I answered that question one time and said, do I have to take that job? My boss said, yes, you have to take the job if it's offered. Yes. So always good advice. So,
love that.
So again, I made that transition over at a time where it was a job. And this is the other thing that's been part of my success, I think, is any job I took, I knew how to do 40% of it the day I stepped into it. Okay. So I went from laundry engineering to laundry product development. And I was on the Sears sales and marketing team. That's a mouthful as well, but it's basically the team here at Whirlpool that sells to Sears. And on that team, you have people that are in charge of the product, like the plan to sell, what the innovation is going to be, and so on. And so you work with the consumer on one half, and you work with engineering on the other half. So it was the perfect job for me. I spent 2 days a week in the tech center, 2 days a week at our administrative center at that time, or our global headquarters, and then 1 day a week with Sears in Chicago.
Awesome.
Great experience. Could not have been better. I will tell anybody that if you get the opportunity to have a sales role or a role on a sales team, even if you're not the salesperson, just being around that atmosphere, you learn so much. That sparked my interest. Then I did a little brand work. I did a little sales work. I did a little bit of merchandising. So I went from laundry engineering to laundry product development. Then I went to dishwasher product development. So I knew the product development. I had to learn dishwashers. Then I went to dishwasher sales. And when I picked up dishwasher sales, they gave me cooking sales. So I had to learn the cooking part and I had to learn the sales part.
I think this is a really important lesson, Casey. Like a lot of engineers that I work with, if they don't feel close to 100% ready for the job that they're applying for, they have a lot of, you know, that imposter syndrome, the uncertainty. Am I good enough? What if I fail at that job? And you know, here you're saying 40% is enough. Like if I can get 40% on day one, then I'm ready. Let's go. And I think that mindset is huge.
I felt really good at 40%. Like that was an advantage. I think most people are 10 to 20% knowledgeable. I mean, I've seen people, again, you take a laundry person doing a product development job. I've seen them go to a kitchen job of one of the categories there. And maybe it's in brand marketing. Guys, those two are completely different things. And so you're making a huge leap at that time.
Yeah.
For me, it just never worked out that way. And it wasn't that I planned. So that was the other thing we talked about. Like, again, I never asked for anything. I didn't have a plan. I will tell you the funniest story, and I've repeated it to other people, but I came to Whirlpool. I took a job. And I think at the time, call it $50,000-ish a year. I don't remember. But I told my wife, I said, if I can just get to manager level, we will be set for life. Like, that's it. That's what we need to get to. And we're going to live nice. We're going to live high and we're going to be great. And of course, as you get each level of engineering and as you become a manager or a senior manager or a director and so on, it's like you learn a little more and you say, oh, you know what? I might want to get to that next level. So I didn't set out saying I want to be a vice president. I never did. I set out saying I knew I was going to be an engineer. I'd like to have some business experience at some point in time. And if I got to manager level, I was going to be all set. And that's kind of how we lived, to be honest, while we were having kids and all those other things. It was just day to day, get through things, keep doing the job, love what you do, and eventually things just continue to roll through.
Casey, I would put you in the category of ultimate overachiever if your original goal was manager. So,
yeah, that's why I say it's a funny story, because people are like, what? I'm like, no, really, that's literally what I said to her.
I think that's sound, wise advice for anybody listening to this conversation, that it's okay, for one, to not want to be VP. There's this weird societal pressure that if you don't want to be the superstar leader, you've got some goal atrophy problem. But, and then on the flip side, to say, I want to really crush it just right where I'm at and maybe focus on that one level up and that's enough for now. That's a really great place to be. It's okay. Yeah. Okay to do that.
When I came to Whirlpool, I was actually a contractor. So, and you work with the people that are already employees. I wasn't even an employee when I came here. Wow. I was a contractor for 6 months. Then I became a permanent. And
that's awesome.
And again, I've been here for 25 years. So
you made a comment earlier, Casey, about having a seat at the table and how that MBA from Notre Dame was for you. You may not have even really known why you needed it other than it represented this ticket. So here you are way on the other side of that. And a lot has changed in the world, and an MBA, you know, people have debating beliefs about what that means. But just in general, if you're an engineering leader looking to get a seat at the table, it's something that's bigger than just the technology side. You want to go into the business, you want to lead, you know, have P&L responsibility, et cetera. What do you think's on that punch list of what it takes to get a seat at the table now? Is it the same or has it changed?
Honestly, I think it's a lot of the same because, again, getting out of the engineering ranks and into the business side, it's going to be tough when they see you as just an engineer. At least when you have that MBA, you can say, no, I know a little bit about business. I think the second thing for me was I was always asking the questions on more than just my space. So I could have designed the suspension I was working on or the chassis I was working on or the electronics or whatever it was. I could have designed those. But it was also a question of why am I designing them and how do they interact with other areas of the unit? And that also then with the consumer. So as I came to Whirlpool, because I grew up in a farm community, I knew about tractors and I knew about farmers and I knew a little bit about that consumer. As I came to Whirlpool, I really had to understand the consumer more. And I learned more and more like, hey, the more you know the consumer, the better your design will be. So even as an engineer, you want to know those consumers. And again, we can all talk to consumers. Call your mom, call your brother, call your sister-in-law, whoever you need to. You can find consumers. They're all over. They all have appliances. And so I spent a lot of time trying to learn that. And as I was on that project about the fabric fresheners I mentioned, we had a dedicated marketing person that I could spend time with and ask a lot of questions and go on the research. So I learned more and more about some of the stuff that was going on. That then gave me a voice when I would talk to somebody about not just the engineering space I was working on, but why it was important I was working on this, why I was developing what I was developing. Was because it meant something to this consumer, and here's why. That's part of the toolkit that people have to understand. I don't think if you just keep your, I'll call it silo blinders on, and focus on just your area and just the engineering part of it, you're going to get a look at the broader picture. You have to have that more well-rounded view, and then you'll start saying, okay, now I understand what's going on here, how I piece things together. And then when you have a conversation with somebody on the business side, they can see it as well.
I just had a conversation last week with a senior manager level leader, I believe, manager or senior manager. And we were talking about this exact concept, you know, hey, how are you doing around building connection points outside of just engineering? And the reason the story pops in my mind, Casey, is because the result of our diagnostic was not good. It's not going well. It really siloed, really just focused on downline, you know, his team and the things that on his roadmap, et cetera. So it was a great F, if you will, in terms of the performance there. And when we probed into like, what are the barriers for why you're not pursuing that? Because there was an immediate response like, oh, I know that's really important. I know it's something I should do. So, okay, well, what's blocking you from doing it? And the response was initially, well, how could I make time for that when I have so much to do already within my own silo? I'm paraphrasing a bit, but just to paint the picture here. So two things for you I'm curious about. One is, how do you approach making that a priority, even back to your engineering days, because you kind of described for me even before we hit record today that this has always been part of your approach. What's the strategy in terms of how you make time for it or fit it in? And maybe the second piece is, can you help us create some more urgency around, like, it's really important, don't miss
sure.
this?
I think I mentioned on our pre-conversation as well, I didn't know, I wasn't like laying out, hey, I want to move to marketing, therefore I'm going to do these things in my job. It just was something my mind said, hey, you should know about the consumer if you're designing for that consumer. And so it's super important. And to your point about making time for it, it was part of my siloed job at the time too. I mean, I was working on, for instance, I was working on the lid and the inside of the lid on a washing project, on a washer project. And of course, I wanted to know all the graphics that were on it. What did they need to say? Well, what did we need to tell the consumer? What did the consumer want to know? What was that use and sure. care kind of quick tips that they want always in front of them on the inside of the lid? The inner lid, as we used to call them. I don't know if you remember, but great in mold decoration before its time, 20 years ago, before it was really being used. So again, a good project. But back to your point, talking about things, again, learning about that consumer, what they were going to do, finding that time, because then you can have the conversation. You don't feel uncomfortable, let's say, having the conversation with the marketing person or the product development person that you're talking to, or even a salesperson for that matter, whoever it may be. You can have a broader conversation if you started to learn those things. Back to, again, workload is always tough. People will say I'm working, you know, crazy hours. Here's the other one I've learned in the last 2 to 3. I knew it even probably 5 years ago, but I really put it into practice the last two in Europe. What I learned was we spend way too much time in meetings, either reviewing something that's already happened in detail that you don't need to know, 30 people in a room and only 3 people talking.
Yes.
So observing, I'll call it. So at that time, I gave my team a very clear message. Look, you don't want to go to a meeting because you don't think it's adding value for us as a company or you as a person, don't go to it. And in fact, then we said, not only that, don't invite people that aren't going to be speaking at the meeting. Then we went to pre-reads where you had to send information in advance, which meant you had to send an elevator pitch because you couldn't send every bit of detail, although that's how it started, 60, 70 page decks. But you couldn't send all that in advance and expect somebody to understand it. So you send them what could be understandable. Then at the meetings, it was, guys, let's just have a conversation about what's going on. What decision do we need to make? Or what's the issue we're dealing with? And what are the things we need to get people's buy-in? Or what's the help needed? And so getting people out of meetings was like my mantra. And it made a huge difference over there. Engagement scores went up 10 plus points. People were happy to be at work. The workload comment was gone. Like it wasn't in the engagement at all. So coming back, I'm seeing a lot of that too. And I've told the teams, guys, again, minimize meetings, minimize people in them, send a pre-read in advance and get to the heart of the issue. I think our fastest toll gate is now, I want to say it was 13 minutes if I remember right.
Wait a second, 13 minutes. These were like 3-hour meetings when I was at Whirlpool Casey.
Exactly. So we're working on it. But to me, that's the time we need to free up, get people out of meetings. Work, get work done. Meetings are not work. Get work done.
Yeah.
And then spend some time on the other things as well.
Meetings are not work. That's my quote of this podcast so far. Meetings are not work.
Think about it. It's true.
Super important. Super important. So, well, if real quick anecdote on this, I have a senior director client and she will not attend a meeting that she didn't receive a concise, clear pre-read on and understands what she's expected to bring and speak about and do as a rule with her team. And, and so I think a lot of people are starting to realize, you know, and Amazon has a really robust culture around this. So people who work within Amazon and that organization with, you know, writing these basically papers about every meeting before they happen. And so pay attention, engineering leaders listening, like, meetings and fix it.
And by the way, two other things on this is one, and again, I'm an engineer, so I fell into this until somebody coached me on it. You want to tell people every detail you worked on, what you did, because you want to get that, that's your work. You want to get credit for that. In the end, I hate to say the leader on the other side of it or the marketing person or, you know, depending on who it is, they want to know the outcome. They want to know the result and the outcome and how it implies to them. And in a language they understand, because that's another thing we have to work on is our language. If we speak to them in a consumer language, boil it down to a few key facts, that's much better than 10 minutes of too much detail that people don't need to know. And I like P&G, I know, does this. They have the one pager, right? I think you may have heard this before. But as the pre-read or the prep for a meeting, you had to send a one page, and it's limited, one page. And you can't font it down to two fonts. You know, it has to be one page. Yeah. So as this two-year progression happened, towards the end, we got to the point where people kind of knew the expectation, but we even put like a template, a number thing together, a guide to say, look, if you're a 15-minute meeting, you get three slides, no more. If you're a half-hour meeting, you get five slides, no more. If you're an hour, no more than 10. And I didn't even like that. I think 10's too many for an hour.
Brilliant. Oh, man. Well, okay. Okay. So there's so many places I want to go, but the thing I know a lot of our listeners will want to understand, for someone who's gone through the number of transitions that you have, reached the next level time and time again, and now even at an even bigger scope than what you've done before, if somebody's in your shoes, they're landed a big opportunity, it's a promotion, it's a big scope, something's changed, what is your lens on how to go from that 40% to the break-even point, or, you know, 100%, whatever you want to call that, as fast as possible, but in a reasonable expectation? Like, how do you think about ramping up? What would be the keys to success for somebody who's looking for, you know, how do I get ready to step into a big opportunity?
I do have a rule on this one. I have a lot of rules. I'm a guideline rule type of person, process, all that. But I also break them all the time, my wife tells me. So, but honestly, the thing I say is 30, 60, 90 days. So as you come into a new role, especially a big role, as you move to a bigger and bigger rank, your shadow gets bigger and bigger. So anything you say goes to a lot more people and a lot more impact and so on. So the first 90 days, my rule is no major changes. So don't come in and think you're going to change the world and start making a bunch of changes, knee-jerk reaction, I would call it, in 90 days. So the first 30 days is really about learning, getting to know the people very well, and really learning the basics of the role and the background and things like that. 30 to 60 is doing, still learning, observing all that, but then starting to think through like, hey, I think this, here's my hypothesis of a change I may want to make. Take note of those to yourself, not sharing them broadly again, because the impact. And then 60 to 90 is, okay, here's the things I believe we need to change. Discuss them with your leadership team or your close-in team before, again, you go broader with them. And then at 90 days, okay, now you have enough feet on the ground time, let's call it background time. Hopefully you won't misstep, because again, in that first 90 days, you could easily take a wrong direction and have a misstep and you just don't need it. And by the way, I always tell whoever I'm coming to work for that same thing. Here's what you should expect from me. I'm going to learn as fast as I can.
Yeah, I love that.
But I'm also going to learn for 30 days. I'm going to think for 30 days and I'm going to start to execute for 30 days. And then I'll be ready to run at 90. And that seems to have worked, again, many times. Again, that 40% start always helps. Having some knowledge before you take the role, whether it's one half or one part of the role, but you have that knowledge, it just helps a ton versus starting out brand new. Starting out brand new, it's the same rules though. Learn for 30 days.
Yeah, just buckle up.
Put stuff together for 30 days and then get ready to go.
Okay, brilliant.
So that's kind of been my go-to, let's say.
I think that's an easy framework to work within. And no surprise, the engineer inside Casey would show up a bit in your rules around onboarding.
Yeah.
If there was one skill set or mindset or something that you bring as a senior leader now that's distinctly different than what you might have thought or believed as a junior engineer, does anything come to mind, Casey, on what really stands out to you as important in yourself and your own development and leadership now versus, you know, when you're in product development and doing the work?
I would say what I see now, what I didn't see then, was then it was all about the work, the engineering, the get stuff done, deliver on deliverables, things of that nature. And of course, there's always some of the, we call it the how here, how you work with others and interact and the team and the people and things of that nature. But I would have said it was 90-10, right? I would have said 90% of the work and 10% of the people side. Now I say it's the opposite. It's 90% of the people side and it's 10% of the work. Mm. And I say that because the only way we're successful is the people that are making it happen. I think that probably that that switch happens over different levels, right? Somewhere in middle management, you get to that 50-50, you're still doing some of the work yourself. But then when you get to director, senior director type role, you're doing 25% of the work and 75% is all your team just delivering. When you get to vice president, I hate to say it's your team doing 99 and I'm doing one.
The work. Yeah.
And so I've been a big believer in that over time, that that's something you have to come to recognize. And as soon as you recognize it, you're going to be better off for it. Your team's going to be better off for it. And our company's better off for it.
Amazing. I love how you painted the kind of arc of that shift over levels and time and growth. Sometimes that person who's maybe you're 2 years out of college, you just got your first engineering job, it seems like the other day, and you're already attempting to put that vice president hat on. It's like, you know, this is something that becomes a part of you through the experiences and the growth and the levels and having that big team. It's not the way you're going to experience your job on day one.
Exactly.
And it's really important.
No, I, like I said, for me, it was always head down, get the work done, and just not go. Think about those other things. And what I learned over time is it basically worked for a while. Now I'm the one doing the opposite, which is going and knocking on doors or asking, hey, who's the upcoming person? Again, that's how I got my roles, is somebody asked someone else.
Brilliant.
Hey, who's the upcoming engineer that we need to bring to product development? And I can remember Dick Conrad was the guy that answered the question. And he said, look, it's Casey, from what I could tell. Because the guy who hired me at that time, Paul Koopmans, I had never met him. I didn't know him at all. And he hired
Amazing.
Me.
Amazing. So perfect segue into the last question. And Casey, I always end in the same place. So if somebody listening to this conversation wants to be that next in line engineer to get picked, they have a desire to achieve success, they want to find that fulfillment in their career, they want to grow. What I believe is that great engineering, great leadership, great coaching have in common something that you and I both learned in OpEx there at Whirlpool Corp, that questions lead, answers follow. And if we want to get better answers in our life, let's ask better questions. So if somebody wants to have that success, what would be a question that you would lead them with today?
I think for me, it would be, what's keeping them from it? What is that barrier? Is it an education? Is it a position? Is it being in the right place at the right time? Is it having a connection to the person who normally gets asked who the next upcoming engineer is? Is it not having the right mentor? There's so many things, but I think the question to ask is why? What is that barrier? And then there'll be subsequent whys beyond that.
Sure. Yeah. What's keeping you from being that next obvious choice?
Yeah. Why aren't you the candidate? Why aren't you the obvious choice? How do you get on the list? All those types of things.
Casey, if someone's immediate reaction to that question is, I don't know, where would you recommend them go first?
I would send them to maybe not their boss in the engineering side, probably someone on the opposite side of the business that interfaces. So, and again, I'm sure some of your clients are Whirlpool people, but so they know that, you know, we interface with product marketing on a regular basis. Talk to the product marketing counterparts. How did they pick their last people they recruited or that they hired?
I love the answer. And what I want to highlight for everybody out there is the answer is almost every time a who. Go start talking to people. And you know, engineers notoriously like to keep to ourselves. We blame introversion or pick another excuse for why that is. But I was hoping you would say something about like, go talk to somebody. And it's exactly what you said. So
for sure it is. For sure it is. You're not going to find it in a book. You're not going to find it in a process manual. It's definitely going to be talking to people.
Awesome. Well, Casey, absolutely amazing opportunity to talk with you today. And if somebody wants to apply for that open job or just follow your success in the future, is there any way that folks would best be suited to connect with you?
Yep. I, by the way, I'm sitting up with the engineering team once again, so they can all walk up to my desk if they're here. But if they're not, I'm on LinkedIn. You can easily find me on LinkedIn and I get those messages direct to my phone. So I'm quick to answer them as well.
Brilliant. I'm sure a lot of the engineering leaders who heard this would be honored to have a chance to connect with you. And certainly if they're wanting to be that next level talent, you better bring your A game because Casey's only looking for A players. So note that. But
you know how we roll.
Absolutely. Casey, thanks again. This has been tremendous.
Thanks, Zach. I appreciate it.
This episode has been brought to you by Massive Action and Decisive Leadership. Okay. No, those are not companies you can just buy success from, but they are qualities you must master if you want to build your career and balance your life. So to help you out, I'm offering my most popular ebook, 49 Things You Must Do to Accelerate Your Engineering Career, for free on our homepage at oasisofcourage.com. If you will take action on just one of these simple tips each week, I promise you will experience a whole new level of results in the coming year. The problem is that we make everything too complex. Success at work is not rocket science. I mean, you might actually be a rocket scientist, and yet you're not getting the success you desire. One engineering senior manager told me that taking action on tip 34 by itself helped him feel happier at work and allowed him to start spending more quality time with his kids. To get your free copy of the ebook, just visit oasisofcourage.com, scroll down to the bottom of the homepage, and click download now. All right, happy engineer. Just you and me for a minute. Let's talk about some of the impact of this conversation with Casey Tubman and how you can apply it and take action in your own career. First, I want to go back and tell you a little story about some of my days working with Casey. And in case you didn't pick up on it, he and I were both at Whirlpool Corporation together. Casey's still there. And when I had landed my first senior manager of engineering position, Casey was the vice president and general manager of the North America region laundry business unit, you know, leading the single largest category in the single largest region of the world there from the business perspective. And I was totally green, complete rookie at my senior manager position. I had just landed within the dryer category. And Casey was the kind of leader who consistently would make time for me, even when he had no reason or need to do that. And I just, you know, for any of you out there listening who are at that senior level, I want to make mention of how powerful those moments can be for the young up-and-comers in your organization, cross-functionally, to make time. I know you're busy. I know you've got a lot of priorities and things you're balancing, and you've got your own families and things you want to do outside the office as well, but never underestimate what being available for some of those leaders under you and around you can really mean. But Casey was that kind of leader. And I remember right after landing that senior manager of engineering position, getting with Casey for maybe a 30-minute mentorship meeting. And Casey did exactly what he described in this conversation. And I didn't bring it up in our chat, but I want to share it with you here. He right away told me, Zach, listen, it's not just about the engineering. It's not just about the technical solutions. You need to think about the customer. You need to think about what we're solving for here for the people who are buying the products. And you got to get exposed to the P&L, to the business side, the profit. Are we making money here? And what do we have to do for the business? And then he told me who. Who do I need to spend more time with? Who do I need to connect with to really create a broader understanding of what's going on cross-functionally and even within engineering, some key people to connect with? Because he had been in that role prior to me getting that promotion. And it was a tremendous value for me. So if you're not in Casey's shoes, but you're in mine, you're the new leader, you're the up-and-comer, you're the person who's seeking to make an impact in a new position, I want to encourage you to go reach out and connect with those who's that can help you get to the next level, that can help you expand your thinking. Who are those people above you, one, two, even maybe three levels above? Have the courage to reach out and ask for that support. So often, they're just like Casey. They want to help you, especially if you are proving yourself and continuing to really demonstrate that you have a big vision and you have a high level of performance, and you just want that little nudge, that little tip, that little bit of help. So go do that. But let's get back to Casey's question, because I think it's really important that we actually spend some time answering it and taking action on it. So take your next goal, your next career goal. What is it? Is it a promotion within your current company? Is it to change companies? Maybe get that dream job at one of the top tech organizations? Maybe it's to leave the Fortune 500 and move to a startup and do something in a small business. Maybe it's to do your own thing, to leave the 9-to-5 altogether and start your own company. Join those of us in the 24/7. That's the joke. But no, seriously, what is that next goal for you? I want you to put that in your mind and ask Casey's question. Well, what is keeping you from being the obvious next choice for that role or keeping you from that goal? All right, in the specific example that popped up today, it might be doing a role outside of engineering. Maybe it's a promotion to a different business unit within engineering. What's keeping you from that goal? Do you know? Do you know how you're perceived? Do you know what other leaders are saying your strengths and your gaps are? What are those gaps? Do you have an answer? And the first thing Casey points to, if you don't know the answer to that question clearly and you're not already taking action to close those gaps and become that obvious next choice or to move the needle on that goal, is who? Who are you going to go talk to? Who's the person who can help you get clarity? I want to share with you one of the most important who's that didn't come up in this conversation. The actual who that's going to make the biggest difference in you reaching that next goal is yourself. You are the biggest who that needs to weigh in and get involved in this problem of you getting to the next level. You are the biggest bottleneck in your own career. You are the biggest problem. Okay, what do I mean by that? Let me back up really quick and talk about a leadership model that shows up in most HR decks and has been talked about again and again. And that is, as you develop as a leader, we start with the concept of leading ourselves, leading self. Then we move on and talk about leading others, leading other people. That first manager position, that first line, you have people reporting to you, mastering those skills of delegation, learning how to deal with some of the organizational politics and hierarchies, leading others. Then you have leading leaders, moving into those director positions, having that second line, maybe even a third line, where you are setting some of the strategy, you're getting a bigger picture, and you're actually helping other leaders to develop their skills. That leading leaders position, and we talk about that. How do you develop that set of skills, and what changes when you're leading just an individual contributor versus leading leaders? And then at the top of this is leading the enterprise, leading the business, leading from the top, being an executive. And what changes when you're in that position Casey talked about, where now 99% of the work is getting done by everyone else? You're only doing 1%, and it's all about the people. It's all about making sure that they're working on the right priorities, setting those standards, really driving the team and developing. Totally different game at leading the enterprise. Well, here's what everyone forgets. In order for you to be successful at leading others, you must also reach the next level of leading yourself. In other words, leading self that made you a top performer as an individual contributor is not enough when it comes to leading self for you to stack on top of that pyramid leading others. I want you to think of leading self as the foundation. It's the bottom layer. So if you're going to add on and pile on to that leading others, you need to strengthen the foundation of leading self even beyond what it took to be successful on your own. When you move to leading leaders and stacking that on top of this pyramid, the strength of that foundation of leading self must increase again. So you don't ever stop learning and developing within yourself. And it's the same at leading the enterprise, probably even the most. At every level, you go back to leading self, and there are breakthroughs and mindsets and tool sets and skill sets that you must develop within yourself to continue to lead at those next levels. It's not just about developing the skills of leading others or leading leaders or leading the enterprise. It's also leveling up your skills of leading yourself. And this is why top top performers in every area of life, whether it's sports, music, or engineering, have coaches. Have people right there beside them, helping them to accelerate and maximize leading themselves. Because you've got enough on your plate to learn how to lead others or lead leaders or lead the enterprise. You know, what happens when you forget to level up on yourself is then that pyramid collapses. That foundation cracks under the weight of the stress and the pressure and all of the expectations that come with you performing at those next levels. And this is that Peter principle people talk about. You've been promoted into your level of incompetence. This is when your responsibilities at work and the growth that you have in your career exceeds the growth that you have within yourself. So, what's keeping you from the goal? You are. Yeah, there might be other things too, but you are. You are the bottleneck in your own career. And I want to challenge you with that and encourage you to take action on leading self. That's exactly what we do at Awaco. I would love to help you with this. If you want to chat, book a call, reach out to me directly. I would love to hear from you. Zach at oasisofcourage.com. It's Zach with an H, Z-A-C-H. But if it's not us, get help from someone. Don't rely on HR to close those gaps for you, because here's the thing. When you become that manager, they're going to provide training for you about how to be a manager. They're focused always on the top level of the pyramid. And you are responsible for making sure that you strengthen that foundation of your growth at the same time, and ideally, even before you need it. I hope this helps. Take action. Make sure that you are focused on your own growth and development. And after you've taken care of yourself, now we can move on to those other who's and really lean into expanding our network, building mentors and sponsors, all the things that come up again and again on the show. All right. I hope that gives you something to chew on. Go take action. Remember to get out of your comfort zone. Crush comfort. That comfort zone is not helping you get what you want out of your life and career. Build courage. Strengthen courage. Create courage every single day by doing something that scares you. Find that edge of the comfort zone. Take action. Have fun doing it. Be like a child again, would you? Just have some fun. It's okay if you fail, because failure is a part of the journey. It's part of life. There isn't success and failure. There's success and learning. And in fact, it's not even success and learning. In the end, it's learning and learning. Have a growth mindset, have fun in the process. And until next time, let's do this. My friend, that's all we've got for this episode of the Happy Engineer Podcast. Thank you again for investing your time with me today. If you're like me, then maybe you'll take some notes and share this episode with your fellow engineers. Why? Because it will help you learn deeper, remember these insights, and take action. So share this episode with two or three friends just like you who are committed to building their career. Lastly, make sure to link up with us at oasisofcourage.com. Grab our free tools for career growth there in the resource hub, and schedule a free call with our coaching team today. Please just share this podcast with anyone who you think might enjoy it. Until next time, remember to crush comfort, create courage, and let's do this.